Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
You could spend the weekend doing the same old whatever, or you could conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Welcome to Speed City with John Massengill, Les Kaiser, and Jonathan Green. It's the fastest hour on the radio, Speed City.
Gearheads, welcome to Speed City, your Sunday night with Speed City. This is John Massengill sitting in the studio, and we are very excited. We have a wonderful show for you tonight. We do have a sad note to the show tonight with the passing of Murray Walker, a legendary broadcaster in Formula One, Murray Walker, and we are very happy to have our guest to help us celebrate the life of Murray Walker. And we have the beloved American Formula One broadcaster, Bob Varsha. Mr. Varsha, how are you, sir?
I'm doing great. Thanks, John. Great to be back with you guys again.
Well, thank you very much. And we also have the iconic race driver, Brian Redman. Brian, Mr. Redman, how are you?
I'm great. Thank you, Jonathan. Excellent shape for an old man.
Happy birthday, by the way.
Yes.
All right. Yeah, thanks very much. Yes. If anybody had told me that I would live 30 years longer than my father, I would never have believed it.
How about it? Yeah.
And you chalked that up to clean living, I'm assuming.
Yes, in some ways, yes. Of course, the racing life is full of temptation, as you all know. I managed to avoid most of it.
Well, and of course, I'm joined by my normal co-host Jonathan Green and Les Kaiser, but we are going to talk a little F1 testing at some point during the show, but we are really dedicating this show to Murray Walker, and I think I want to start with you, Mr. Varsha, and talk about what Murray Walker meant to you. And maybe how you met him.
Well, I first met Murray in the Australian Grand Prix on the old Adelaide Street Circuit. I believe it was 1989, which was the first year that I went there for ESPN. I had begun working with David Hobbs. This was toward the end of the season, of course. Somehow, Murray and David and I managed to avoid each other until that very last race of the year. And we were just wandering the paddock. And of course, you know, Murray spotted David and zoomed right in on him. And I met him and he said some nice things about our new partnership. And then up pulls this limousine. And in the back window, giving us the Queen's own wave, was 76 world champ James Hunt, who was so synonymous with Murray for so many years on the BBC. So that was where we first met. I must say it's a shame that our paths didn't cross very much. We were in attendance at pretty much every race back in those days. The BBC didn't attend every one, so the opportunity to chat with Murray wasn't always there. But I was able to meet him and talk with him on a few occasions, and I treasure all of them. Mm-hmm. As to what he means, well, you know, this is going to come out like blasphemy, so I have to be very careful about how I say this. Murray, in my view, starting way back when he did in the late 1940s, became, I think, the model for British commentators that followed him. High pitch, lots of excitement, high energy, constant words. I mean, talk, 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 talk. And to this day, I think a lot of announcers, and I'm looking at you, Jonathan, tend to admire, yeah, and mimic that style. It's not correct, my style, but I've always, thought, Lord, how does he do that? But that was authentic Murray. And I think his influence is felt to this day and will be well into the future.
Well, I want to ask you, Brian, really the same two questions. You know, what, how did you meet him and first time? And then what does he mean to you?
Well, I, of course, heard him in the early days, in the late 50s and 60s, rather than meeting him. I started really professional racing in 1969. And so I met him, but only a few times, not so many times, until Goodwood at the festival, sorry, the revival, the race week on Thursday afternoon. They have cricket on the cricket pitch in front of Goodwood House, and he was an umpire. And probably 7 years ago, I was a reluctant outfielder. You know, I was on the outfield hoping the ball wouldn't come my way, but unfortunately it did. And I picked it up and I raised my hand, you know, to throw it back to the wicket. It was quite some distance and my shoulder was hurting a bit, so I thought I'll do it underhand. So I ran as fast as I could, and I gave a mighty swing with my hand and let go. And then I looked to see where it had gone, and I couldn't see it. And so I looked in the air, and fortunately, it was just in time to dodge to one side as it landed just where I was standing. So I said to Lord March, as he was then, I said, thank you very much, Charles. I said, I have now retired from playing cricket. And he said, would you care to be an umpire? And I said, of course. And so for several years, probably 4 years, I was an umpire with Murray. And that's really where I got to know him the best. a wonderful, wonderful character and a wonderful person.
Well, and I want to go to you, Jonathan Green, next, because Bob Varsha was talking about Murray's style. And, yeah, and the commentators have followed him. And you freely admit that you modeled your style after
him. Yeah, as a commentator, you try not you don't want to impersonate anybody because you'll be found out within seconds. So you got to try to get your own style, and in order to be credible, you've got to have that, because if you just do an impersonation, you're making fun of that person and you have no credibility. We really don't. But Bob, I've never heard anybody put it that way, but Bob is absolutely right. He if you wanted to make it in motorsport in Britain, you had to have a touch of that. And I picked up on the passion that Murray had for the sport. And also, my father, and Brian will admit to this, my father was very much mechanical engineering and into the engines and so on. I've never been into the engines, and I've never been into the cars as themselves. I've always been into racing drivers and what they do. And as a sportsman, I've always idolized that. And so I think Murray was like that too, and that's why he was so beloved. So if anything, my pursuit of trying to be, you know, a Murray Walker type person was to try to do two things. I always felt that motor racing on TV was actually pretty dull with the sound down. And so that high pitch that Murray brought to it brought a sense of urgency and a sense of drama to Formula One that just captivated me as a child, for exactly what Bob's reason, which was it high, but you couldn't, you know, you wanted to go and make a cup of tea, and then Murray would just explode, and you'd be like, what happened? And Mansell had blown a tire or something. And so there was that sense that he kept you coming back. And I agree with Bob, it's not everybody's cup of tea, and a lot of people are maligned for that style of commentary. If you listen to horse racing in England, it's very similar. It goes on a very monotone pattern for a while and then suddenly explodes in the final furlongs. And it's just a style that has definitely been cultivated by Britain. And of course, the early days of television, most people listened to British announcers per se. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, no question. I mean, if there's two people in my life that have influenced me in why I love motorsport, it's Brian, because I met him through my family at a very young age and started going to places like Brands Hatch when I was 3 and watching and listening to Murray Walker. And I never thought I would. I mean, that was a pipe dream to do commentary. So I feel very blessed to have been part of Formula One, even for just a short period.
Well, I want to play a clip of Murray, because I think, Jonathan, you found this clip on YouTube, and it really, it's a fantastic clip. It typifies everything that everyone's just been talking about. Let's play that.
gentlemen, that we've got our monitors back again. We're riding with Jacques Villeneuve, sector one into turn four, the right-hander, and Jacques Villeneuve is inside Frentzen's time. Now this is the fast track down to turn five, 185 miles an hour. Back off into second gear, 55 miles an hour on the apex, accelerate round the left-hander, it keeps on going, 145 miles an hour, 165 miles an hour, and he moves up into provisional pole position.
Well, that's more like it. That's the kind of lap times we were expecting to see. That's given them all a wake-up call. There's so much time under braking here for this chicane.
Oh, look at that, three-tenths of a second inside. This is terrific. Michael Schumacher is going to move up into provisional pole position if he just keeps up this speed. He comes into the last corner now, in tight on the apex, get it steady, boot it hard, over the grid and over the line goes Michael Schumacher and moves up into second place with a time exactly the same as Jacques Villeneuve's to the nearest 1/1000th of a second. They've both done
all right. I know that I could see all of you smiling, every one of you smiling. And I, you know, Bob, I was really watching your face too, because I could see when they showed the commentary booth that you just lit up. And I mean, I want to hear your thoughts. What was running through your mind?
Well, the first thing I noticed was the body English. You know, while Murray is talking, he's leaning left and right and he's forward and back and, you know, mimicking the track turns with his hand. I mean, that's somebody who is totally immersed in what he's doing. And I also thought, there's poor Martin Brundle, you know, looking for his wedge to get something in there, because Murray, and this may be inside baseball as far as, you know, commentary is concerned, in Murray's role, which I would assume would be my role, I'm not supposed to be telling the guy how to drive the car, you know, and I'm not supposed to say, you know, how fast he's going or what the G-forces are in the corners or all that kind of stuff. That's what Martin's there for. But, you know, this is Murray. This is what he does. And I think he did so many races solo without a partner in the booth over the years, and not just racing, but the other sports he covered. So, you know, it was just second nature to him to paint the whole picture for the viewer or the listener.
Yeah. And I just think that he did that so fantastically. I've just been amazed at everyone responding on Twitter, like starting with Martin Brundle talking about how he's a national treasure. And I think it's just everybody, especially in the UK, but he was on here in the United States as well. And Les, I haven't talked to you about this really even off air, but I know that you watch enough Formula One to remember him in the United States as well.
You're right. I mean, it was one of those guys that I honestly could not recall his name, but when I heard his voice, I immediately knew that's the same guy.
Yeah.
And catching up with it, I've watched a lot of videos today, waking up to that news. And I got to say, there's one thing I hope I can glean from him as well. I mean, I've gleaned a lot from, or, you know, affectionately call him Uncle Bob here, but from Murray, he made his mistakes funny and polished and informative. He would correct him and made him an education.
Right.
He was part of learning it himself. And I appreciate that,
yeah.
That he wasn't a know-it-all. is that what you heard, Brian and Bob?
Go ahead, Brian.
Well, I don't see, as I say, I didn't know it so well, really, until I started playing cricket at Goodall. Of course, I'd listened to him many times, but I hadn't met him very many times. And so we actually became good friends at Goodwood and had many funny moments, one of which was my fault entirely. But they told us that we stopped for tea, afternoon tea, at 4 p.m. And they said, if anybody is out, you know, for any reason between 5 to 4 and 4 o'clock, don't count them out. Well, about 3 minutes to four, Alan de Cadenet came in, you know, who's well known to all the motoring people and so on. So the first ball comes, but they were running late. They didn't stop at four. So at 3 minutes past four, the ball comes down and he's LBW, leg before wicket. So I signaled it out. This caused a huge row. And Murray had a few words to say as well. But anyway, it worked out. And Alan Buchanan, they said, "Well, you should, that's a great pity, old chap. You know, I'm pretty good cricketer." Anyway, he was out. Yeah. Friends of
us. You mentioned his Murrayisms, you know, and his self-deprecating way. Both are true. And I used to tell people Murray had the best job in the world because he could be wrong all day long and people loved him for it. Like, oh, there's old Murray, got it backwards again. Well, they even, as I recall, they bound his Murrayisms into a book at one point. You know,
yes.
It was a big seller.
That was pre-Twitter.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Imagine that on today, Twitter. People would just shred you, which is ridiculous, but yeah.
Yeah, he was famous for those things. And he was, as I said, self-deprecating. Years ago in American television, they would always tell you, you know, you are the expert. You're the guy talking on TV. Don't ever admit that you're wrong unless you have no way out of it. Which I always thought was really a silly thing, you know, because you want the viewer to get the total accurate experience. So you want to be, you know, called out on it when you get something wrong. Yeah, it doesn't have to be cruel. Just say, whoops, that's not quite right. I've certainly had more than my share of those things. But again, Murray was, you know, like, holy moly, I got that wrong. And he did it in such a graceful, funny way over
which
and over.
Which he did Murray often.
Give you one example. I should imagine that the conditions in the cockpit are totally unimaginable. That's a good Murrayism. But you know what? I got a question for Brian here. Brian, your Formula One era was the early 70s with several different teams. Was Murray part of that? And, you know, another question really, if that's not the case, as a racing driver, and Bob's kind of alluded to this, there is a humbleness, which is what he had in spades, because a know-it-all is not popular, especially if you aren't a racing driver like myself and Bob. So you do hope that you do have a racing... I always hope to have a racing driver next to me because we haven't been there. So how can we have any opinion about what it's like to go down the Mulsanne straight as you have at 210 miles an hour or whatever it might be? So commentators play a role that is both important but can be probably quite annoying to somebody like yourself, who is actually doing the driving and having to listen to it back later.
Yes. What's happening to
mulling over incidents in his mind.
Why is my shirt flashing up and down like that?
I don't know. You put it on.
The ratings will go
on,
sky
Brian,
high.
Go on, Brian.
There you go.
All right. Yeah, fair enough.
Yeah, it's a first.
Show us some injuries. That's very nice, actually. Show us some injuries.
Next week, appearing on the show, Beyonce.
Yes, I'm looking forward to that.
Hey, that's it. We're going to have Bob Marsh as the DJ announcer for the reveals.
Yeah, I learned something, not to put on a multicolored shirt.
Yeah, that's good. No, it's good. You're down in Florida. That's fine. It's warm.
There you go. So, problem solved.
So can we get back to the question?
What was the question, Jonathan?
What was the question?
Well, it was about Brian's era in Formula One. I just wanted to hear a little bit about whether, I don't know, was Murray commentating back then in Formula One? Because, as you said, he was...
You know, my first foray into Formula One was 1968, and my first race was South Africa, Kyle Army, where John Cooper, I was driving a Cooper, pumped oil out of the Maserati engine in every direction. And he said to me, "Brian, please try and do five laps. We need the starting money." So I did five laps, covered the circuit in oil, and retired. And then the next race, everybody really broke down. I finished third behind Graham Hill and Denny Hulme at the Jarama, the Spanish Grand Prix in 1968. And then the next race was the Belgian Grand Prix at Spa-Francorchamps, the fastest, most dangerous track in the world at that time, where just a month before, Jackie Ickx and I had won the 1,000-kilometer race in the GT40, the Golden Wire Automotive Engineering GT40. And on about the seventh lap, I whistled into a corner called Likoum. It's still there today. But today at Le Coum, everybody goes right onto what is effectively a new circuit. In those days, we went left and disappeared into the Belgian countryside. So I come whistling into Le Coum, clamped the anchors on, and nothing much happened. And so I've always thought, you know, I'd rather going backwards than forwards. So I tried to spin it, as the steering was locked. And the next minute, I had a huge accident. I disappeared over the barrier. This arm got caught between the barrier and the car, and I had a compound fracture. Three wheels came off, one of which hit a corner work island and right in a corner worker's post. And so that was only my third Grand Prix. So I was then out of Grand Prix racing until 1972. So that was 4 years later. And so, you know, I didn't really, you know, I wasn't in Formula One so much that I'd met Murray frequently. I've no doubt that sometimes I saw him, but not all the time by any means. So.
Jonathan, I want to ask you about a story because you told me, you gave me goosebumps when we were just driving in the car, talking on the phone, and told me about Murray Walker commentating on the Ayrton Senna, the day that Ayrton Senna died.
Yeah, I for the best part of 6 years, I worked in Asia, in Hong Kong at Star TV. And we had a show called Grand Prix Sunday, and we did MotoGP, Formula One. But we were very remote. We didn't, you know, we didn't go to a lot of races because of where we were. And also there was no experts out there. There was no racing drivers to talk of. We had one event, a major event, which was the Macau Grand Prix, which Murray would commentate for some 30 years, actually. Yeah, when May 1994 came round, obviously I was watching and on air at the time. Our commentary team was the BBC's, and we would throw, I think it was the BBC still, but Murray was doing the commentary. And you see a lot of, as a presenter, and Bob will tell you this, you see a lot of crashes. And it's, again, it's a commentary thing, which is don't jump in and start to give your opinion on the crash. You aren't there. You don't know what's happening. But you are trying to inform the audience of everything you know. And the initial accident when he went off at Tamburello was not innocuous. It was a fast accident, but he had gone a long way into the gravel, and it looked as though, you know, the car was okay. But then a helicopter shot came down, and Murray began talking, and his voice changed quite dramatically, where he could tell, and he often had this, what he called a lump in his throat. And I could hear this sort of almost past tense Murray talking live over a helicopter shot, saying, "We are, you know, we're not really aware of what the situation is. We will bring it to you when we can." But I immediately turned to my studio guest and I said, "He's hurt. He's hurt bad." Mm-hmm. And I knew, and it was just Murray's tone, by just literally worshiping him and listening to him for so many years, that I knew something more was wrong than, I mean, you know, we'd had an accident the day before with Barrichello, and you know, and you see, I mean, look at Grosjean's accident, same thing. I had that same sinking feeling with Grosjean, and you know, you do not comment on something like that. You try to path, am I right, Bob? You can't, you're not there, and no, you've got completely to be responsible.
Completely. And more often than not, there are loved ones and close friends and stuff on the other end of the television show who are also looking at information, and you cannot speculate about those things. This kind of goes back to what I was saying before about having an ex-racing driver, a blue ribbon athlete of some sort there to judge the quality of what we're looking at. I'm just there to get us in and out of commercials and tell you, you know, what's at stake and who the stars are and all that sort of thing. But I'm not going to say anybody's doing good, better, or indifferent. But several times in my career, and on that weekend especially, I just, you know, looked over at my colleague, who in this case was Derek Daly, and he knew immediately. Racers see races differently than, you know, the relatively untutored like ourselves. And Derek knew immediately. He just shook his head. I mean, we didn't say anything, but we waited. We were at the basement of Bristol, Connecticut at ESPN. We had not traveled to the race, which in a way was kind of a good thing because we had the news gathering capabilities of ESPN. And I think we found out before they announced anything in the press room at Imola. But, you know, it was pretty clear to racers who know, and Brian, you've written about this in your book about dangerous tracks and so on. Racers know. They know.
Bob, do you have a moment like Jonathan about Murray's commentating? Do you use something that stands out in your mind?
Well, if I'm honest, it's the Murrayisms that stand out in my mind. I mean, it was after working for years with Dorsey Schrader, who had that same gift for totally mangling, you know, a sentence and coming around back again. I have to be honest and say that I didn't get to see so much of Murray's work because I was in the next booth over or what have you. I will say this, I saw amidst all of the tributes to Murray, one that included a clip of an interview in which Murray said that the one sport he never got to cover that he would have liked to was snooker. You know, the game that's like, it's like pool without pockets. You know, you bounce balls off walls and I have no idea how the thing is scored. But Murray wanted to commentate on snooker, which is like the 18th green at the Masters. You
Correct.
Know, talk about it like this the whole time. Can you imagine Murray Walker whispering?
It would have been interesting.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, there's so much about Murray we didn't really.
Well, I've never heard Jonathan Green whisper, so I don't know if it actually.
Hey, to get a word in with my father, you can't whisper. Brian's robed again. That's good. It is his family show, and my mother's watching Brian, so we can't.
Oh, dear.
No. He's used to being on the beach in Florida.
We'll find you a BR.
I think it was because I was on that small thing. I could sort of, my shirt was flashing like this every time I moved, but it's not now. So
yeah, not enough pictures.
Okay, yeah, okay.
Right.
Yes, yes.
Well, yeah. how did you two guys meet? I want to ask Bob and Brian, how did you two guys meet?
By sharing a broadcast booth. How else would you expect? St. Petersburg Grand Prix back in the early to mid 80s. There were actually three of us, David Hobbs, Brian, and myself. May have been the first time I worked with both of them. So that was the beginning.
All right, gentlemen, we need to take a break and get a couple of commercials in. And when we come back, we're going to continue our discussion about the legendary Murray Walker. And we'll probably try to sneak in a little F1 testing at some point during the show. You're listening to Speed City live from Austin, Texas. Back after a short break.
Winding Road Racing is your first and best choice for all the essentials for a great weekend at the track. We're racers, and we love helping racers. With a full selection of racing gear in stock, get geared up with all the safety equipment needed to meet all the latest Snell FIA and SFI regulations. Outfit your car with a comprehensive lineup of racing necessities, and when you need to find a few more tents, turn to data acquisition systems from AIM Sports, V-Box, and others. Austin-based with shops in California, Georgia, and Kentucky, the source for all your racing needs. Winding Road Racing, WindingRoadRacing.com.
Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/recommend today.
When you're looking for traditional Tex-Mex, look no further than an Austin favorite, One in a Million. Serving original family recipes since 1980 and located just minutes from downtown at 2300 East Cesar Chavez, One in a Million has your Tex-Mex fix every day of the week from 7 a.m. to 3 p.m. Breakfast is served all day. Homemade migas, enchiladas, and menudo. And try the Don Juan Taco. Some say it's big enough to feed a family of four. One in a Million. Online at oneinamillion.com.
Talk 1370. Welcome back to the fastest hour in radio, Speed City.
Bit of goosebumps there for me, for sure. I'm sure everybody a little bit. But, well, welcome back to the show. And we are celebrating the life of Murray Walker. And we are joined by Bob Varsha and Brian Redman. And thank you, gentlemen, for joining us. And I think I want to go to you, Brian, next. I want to ask you first about your book and then maybe some of your worst moments or accidents in your illustrious career.
Right. What do you want to know?
Well, first of all, let's ask you about your book. Tell us about your book.
The book, it was a huge drama, really. Jim Mullen, a friend of mine and a racer, successful racer and a big businessman, huge businessman, he decided about 2014 that it would be a good idea to do a book. I wasn't too keen because I had an idea of the anyway, it went on, and it finally came out in March of 2016, around the Goodwood time. And it's actually done pretty well for a motor racing book, I think. It's now, we've printed 7,500, and there's about 100 copies left at the US distributor. So it's been okay, but it's a big pain. You know, you're shipping books, you're going somewhere to ship, you know, 50 books, and you sell 10, and you have to ship 40 back. So, but anyway, it's been very good, and I certainly owe Jim Mullen a big, you know, thank you for doing it. It was good.
Well,
I gotta jump in. Sorry to jump in unannounced, but guys, we need to get these two men to come to Austin for USGP. Can you imagine an evening with these two stories going?
Be good.
They both
I'd like
great
it.
Books. I want to hear more of this, and what an evening that could be.
It would be fun.
I'm in.
You know, in terms of acting, in many ways, I've been extraordinarily lucky in, you know, in getting out of pretty bad accidents and still being pretty well, you know, okay at an advanced age. But so many of my compatriots, they had one big accident and they were gone. That was it. It was unbelievable, you know, in the 60s. And even the early 70s when things were starting to get better. But in 71, I'd done taking a one-off drive for Porsche on the Targa Florio. The Targa Florio was 44 miles to one lap. And they say 800 corners per lap. I've never actually counted them. Well, Joseph and I had won it in 1970 in the factory Porsche 9083. And I'd retired foolishly from racing at the end of 1970, and I'd come back 4 months later, and I didn't have a drive, but John Wire called and said, would I like to do the Targa Florio? But Derek Bell, who'd taken my place in the Gulf Porsche team, had never done it. And so to me, it looked like a great opportunity to get back. And so anyway, Joe Siffert, my co-driver, crashed the car the day before the race, pretty hard actually. Worked on it all night. Next day, John Wyatt said to me, Redmond, we'd like you to start. Well, normally, Siffert started. And I said, you know, what for? He said, I don't want Rodriguez and Siffert knocking each other off. You know, they were always hanging like this. And so I started. And right from the start, the handling of the car wasn't normal. And so 22 miles round the 44-mile circuit, the steering broke in a pretty simple corner. And just before the race, the Porsche engineer Helmut Schlegel said to me, Edmund, if you must have the accident, do not crash on the right side. So I immediately a stone kilometer post in the right side, and it exploded. I was extremely lucky to get out. I was on fire from head to foot and spent several weeks recovering from that. And then in 1970, after winning three Formula 5000 championships in 74, 5, and 6, with Mario finishing second for 2 years, they changed the rules. They made us put bodywork on the open wheel single seater. I go to Sandrevieux, Canada for the first race of the new season in early June of 1977. I haven't seen the car before, but I know, prepared by Chaparral and Jim Hall and Franz Weiss, it'll be good. I go out, it's good. I come in, Jim Hall said, how is it? I said, good. What do you want? You know, meaning you want to change the balance of the car. And it was just oversteering a bit too much. So I said, take quarter of an inch off the front wing, lower it a quarter of an inch. And on the next lap, at 170 miles an hour, it took off, went straight up in the air. down. The roll bar broke. I went down on the road, wore the helmet away. It broke my neck, C1, broke my shoulder, split my breastbone, broke my ribs. My heart stopped, but fortunately, as it rolled off the track, it landed on its wheels. And the track doctor was a heart specialist. They got my heart going. And then the ambulance put a tire on the way to hospital. And when Marion arrived from England the next day, the headline in the Montreal paper showed the ambulance with the two guys working on the wheel and me in the back not looking too good. It said, I read my name or Redman is dead. So
that was the headline?
That was the headline.
So oh. Yes. So I've been pretty lucky, really, haven't I?
That's a bad day.
Yeah, when the ambulance crashes on the way to the hospital, that really sucks. That's a bad day at the office.
There is more. There is so much more. I unreservedly recommend Brian's book.
Yep.
Especially for the candor. Brian is very upfront about his attitude toward racing and the odds of surviving or not. And it's just fascinating stuff if you like racing and racing drivers.
Thank you.
And John, if I may, I think what's interesting both about the book and about Murray's career and why Murray was so special to a lot of racing drivers was he had a passion not just for the sport, but for the men and women involved. And so that's why that Senna thing hit him so hard, as was Damon Hill's victory, having probably seen his father win his world championship. So Murray had a special relationship with a lot of racing drivers that not many commentators have had the privilege to have. And while he didn't drive himself, he really genuinely loved the guys that he commentated on. And they loved him for the same reason. Jenson Button, Ayrton Senna, they were friends with Murray Walker. And it meant a lot to him. And if they didn't succeed or they were hurt in any way, it hurt him. And you could hear it in his commentary. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's another connection there that is so special, because as Brian will attest, his era and Murray's era were without doubt the worst. A crash like Grosjean's that we saw recently pretty much happened every week.
Mm. Yes, yes. I think Murray did actually race motorcycles, didn't he?
Yes, he did.
Yeah.
And Brian, I want to ask you, Jonathan was telling me a story about you. Speaking of crashes and the dangerous time that it was, that era, that you turned down a Ferrari drive because of the attitude they had towards drivers?
Yes, in some ways, yes. I mean, I got a call from engineer Mauro Fageri in 1968. Brian, you come to Maranello and test Formula 2, Formula 2 at Modena. So I go. Now, it started off pretty well when I walked into the glass door of the hotel without seeing it. So that was the first evening. So anyway, at lunchtime, after whistling around Modena a few times, it was lunchtime. So we're having a sandwich, and Gary says, Brian, over there, under the trees, in the raincoat, this is Signor Ferrari. So what he's really saying, of course, is go faster. So we go to the Nürburgring South Circuit, the Sundschleife, as it's called, which is very similar to the main circuit in the uphill and downdale hedges, of course, in those days. No barriers, no curbs, nothing. And I was going okay, and about probably 10 minutes from the end of qualifying on the Saturday afternoon, I came in the pits, and Mauro Ferreri says, Brian, why are you stopping? And I said, well, I've gone as fast as I can. He said, Brian, you are in 10th place. Go out and try harder. Out I go, drive like a maniac for 10 minutes. I go 1/10 of a second faster than I'd already done. And I was in 4th place. I'd never been in 10th place. And so the race started, and there was I was behind Kurt Ahrens. Jackie Ickx was the team leader in the Ferrari. Piers Courage was second. Kurt Ahrens was third. I was fourth. We're all together. We just came past the pits early on, third or fourth. And bang! I think, no, my World War II goggles shattered. And I thought I'd been hit in the eye with a stone. Kurt Ahrens had put a wheel on the dirt. And so I did a slow lap. So I go about 4 miles, you know, with no goggles. But to reduce speed, I come in the pits and forget it. Wear your spare goggle. I said, I don't have any. He said, take Ickx's. He said, and they were dark green and they were okay in the sun, but not quite as good under the trees. So I drive, you know, like a maniac. One, not a thought in my head, you know. And I'm gaining 2 seconds a lap on the leaders, and I finish fourth. And set the fastest lap, et cetera, et cetera. But when I got back into the sport hotel, the old hotel built in the 1930s, I sat on the bed, you know, like this, my head in my hands, going through it all. And then we go to dinner, and goes away, comes back. He says, I speak with Signor Ferrari. For the rest of the year, you drive a Formula Due, Formula 2, and in September, at Monza, Formula Uno, Formula 1. I said, no, thank you.
Not many men can say that.
What do you mean, no, thank you? I said, if I drive for Ferrari, I'll be dead by the end of the year.
Yeah, well, I think a lot of people in that era wouldn't have had the guts to say that, wouldn't have said no to. Who says no to Enzo Ferrari? That's amazing.
Well, I think it's possible. I didn't really have enough ambition. I didn't have that great ambition, you know, to be a Formula One world champion, like so many. I think probably all Formula One world champions have that tremendous ambition. Because I raced against Jody Scheckter in 1973 when he was on his way up. And right then, that's what he's going to be. So I'm going to be world champion, you know. I never had any thoughts like that. There we are.
Well, Jonathan, you did some great imitations of Murray Walker, some other Murrayisms. You've got to give us a couple more, please.
Oh, okay. Hang on. I've got a list of them, but excuse me while I interrupt myself. I like that one. The lead car is unique, except for the one behind, which is identical.
That's my favorite.
Either the car is stationary or it's on the move.
Oh, those are great, John.
What's the one about the car is in fine shape, except it's on fire?
Except it's on fire, yes.
the great thing is that he wasn't doing it on purpose.
No.
No, exactly.
All right, guys. Well, we got to get into the commercial break in. Let's do that now. And when we come back, we'll continue our discussion and our tribute to Murray Walker. Listen to Speed City back after a quick break.
As a rider, you know what you like. The power, the feel, the ride. When it comes to gear, you know what keeps you safe. Ducati Austin provides riders with the finest in day and easy leathers, the best the market offers. Visit Ducati Austin on Breaker Lane just east of I-35 and throw your leg over the most iconic sports bike ever built. Ducati. Even take it for a test ride or see what's been described as art on wheels from MV Agusta. You know what you like. See it at Ducati Austin. Online at DucatiAustin.com.
You could spend the weekend doing the same old whatever, or you could conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage, to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is here to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 15% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. And sell more with less effort thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. And Shopify is the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Plus, Shopify's award-winning 24/7 help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/odysseypodcast, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/odysseypodcast now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/odysseypodcast.
Hi, I'm Lauren Sherman, the host of Fashion People. I love fashion, obviously, but shopping for fashion online is kind of annoying. There's endless scrolling, my size is always out of stock, and I can't actually find what I want. No one has really made this work for me. That is until List. Instead of browsing different stores one by one, on List you can see and shop all of the best fashion. List is the secret shopping weapon now used by all my most stylish, cool, and in-the-know friends. Don't shop around. Join 200 million fashion shoppers, including me, on List.com. That's L-Y-S-T. Or download the List app on the App Store today.
Motivation USA, catering to the sport bike enthusiast looking for truly unique parts and accessories. Stand out from the crowd. Motivation is the exclusive North American distributor for SC Project Moto GP inspired exhausts and the largest Rizoma retailer in the United States. Get the best parts from around the world at the best prices with fast shipping and a knowledgeable staff ready to help. Shop online 24/7 at motivationusa.com. That's motivationusa.com.
Talk 13-7, the right choice.
Welcome back to the fastest hour in radio, Speed City.
And David Hill exits the chicane and wins the Japanese Grand Prix. And I've got to stop because I've got a lump in my throat.
There's that lump in the throat that you were talking about, Jonathan.
You know, what I, and Bob will back me up here, you know, at the end of a race, especially when it's a championship, you have one chance and it's a 2-second chance to get it right. Now, you can either write something or you can go off the moment. And obviously, it's better to go off the moment, but you hope you get it right and don't muddle your words. And that was just a glorious moment for Britain. It was 3 a.m. When Damon won the world championship, and it was just the perfect, everybody felt it and everybody knew that that was the appropriate, because it knew what it meant for Murray and it meant to the nation to see the son of a world champion win a world championship, because Damon had not dedicated his whole life to it, but he, you know, it was so important to him, and that's the only reason he went into motor racing, was to, if you like, try to emulate what his father had achieved.
We just got a nice tweet sent to us by Andy P. He says he actually learned of Murray Walker through an F1 video game. He's obviously younger on the original PlayStation. He said he lent his voice, and he had never heard him before, even though that imperfect vehicle, you could hear his passion and love for the sport. RIP to a legend. Thanks, Andy P. We appreciate you, you chiming in. Well, I want to ask both you guys. We have Bob Varsha and Brian Redman with us. I want to ask you a little bit about current F1. Bob, I want to start with you. I know you said you didn't get to see all the testing or anything, but it is interesting to see that Mercedes is not dominating testing, and they don't really look comfortable yet. I mean, do you think there's actually a shot at Mercedes not winning this year?
Well, you know, hard to say. This is going to be such an interesting year, in that the teams are basically using last year's cars with permissible upgrades. The engines will be much different. Certainly Ferrari hopes so. But all signs will be pointing toward next season when a whole radically different rules package will come into effect. So every team now has to decide, how do we divide our resources? How much development do we do on the car we've got now, as opposed to getting down to brass tacks with next year's car? Having said that, yes, Mercedes does appear to have problems. In fact, somebody on the internet today pointed out Mercedes did no, you know, what they call their filming day testing before going to Bahrain. So everybody's going to be looking closely at the car to see if it changes when they do their filming day, because they obviously have some issues in terms of reliability with the gearbox failing Valtteri Bottas on day one. I think there's a very realistic chance that Mercedes could be challenged, at least in the early part of the season.
Well, this is where I don't have to channel my inner Murray Walker, because I am about to bounce off the ceiling, looking forward to the ceiling this season. I am so excited because there are so many different stories. I mean, last year was, we didn't even know if we're going to get a season, and it turned out to be incredibly fun and entertaining. But this year, there's so many cool stories, and I'm going to ask you one more question, Bob, and then go to you, Brian. But Bob, of all the different things that are happening this year, what are you most looking forward to?
Well, certainly we'll be watching Ferrari to see if they can bounce back. I mean, they had a very unrepresentative season last year. And they need to make changes. You know, they need to do something drastic, keeping in mind that they've still got this 2022 car that has to be envisioned and created. I'll be interested to see how their driver lineup of Carlos Sainz Jr. and Charles Leclerc go. I'm really happy to see that the old boys, I mean, Kimi Raikkonen did something like 166 laps.
Yeah.
Today. I mean, that's for a guy his age, and Fernando Alonso comes back. He did like 120 or 30 laps. I mean, these guys seem fit and ready to go. So it's going to be interesting to see if it's going to be all the new boys, or if we're going to see, you know, a fight back from the Alonzos of the world. Daniel Ricciardo could be an interesting addition at McLaren. And I'm not trying to ignore any of the kids, you know. And then, of course, there's Haas, who have such a PR hole to dig themselves out of.
Yeah.
Yeah. Decisions on driver lineup, you know. And then there's Williams, you know, Williams, who have been so bad for so long now, a team with all of their achievements. Now they've got fresh faces, fresh thinking, and fresh money. And, you know, maybe Williams could do something this year. So you're right, John. It's going to be fascinating to watch all this play out.
Well, Bob, I want to go back to Haas F1, because we dedicated a good bit of the show last week about the new livery that essentially looks like a Russian flag. And we were talking about selling hats and everything here in the United States. You know, I know Gene has talked about his focus is the rest of the world, but my goodness, as an American team, a Russian connection so deep like this, what do you think? Are we off base and thinking that's going to be a big problem, or?
Hey, we all know who talks loudest. You know, the Washingtons and Lincolns and Grants and yep. All that sort of thing of the world. I don't, in principle, have a problem with an American team aligning itself with Russian sponsorship. You know, I think putting the red, white, and blue of the Russian flag on the car and you know, attracting the attention of the World Anti-Doping Agency and all these other things, it's going to make for another great season of Drive to Survive.
Yeah,
got to be really happy. It's different. Again, it's one of those stories. We'll see what happens. What kind of reaction we get around the world? That and the schedule is going to be another cut and paste. What will the pandemic do to all the best laid plans?
Yeah.
The list goes on and on.
I got a question for Brian. Brian, I just want to get your take on effectively Force India of old now basically being rebranded as Aston Martin. And of course, it started off as the Jordan team way back when, but has been through some permutations. But they've really made the effort to go British Racing Green with the British flag on. And for those that don't know, Brian drove at Le Mans many, many times, but more importantly, brought Aston Martin back to Le Mans, and I was there that weekend. It was great. I think you finished 12th. But it
11th.
Was but it was great. But you can relate to what Aston Martin means to the British racing fans. And I remember that Le Mans, it didn't matter where you finished. The British fans were just so delighted to see that name back in racing. And so what are your thoughts on what is a very bold move by Lawrence Stroll to do that?
Well, it is. Of course, the history of Aston Martin from the beginning and through until today has been extremely checkered. You know, the company going out of business, coming back into business, bought by Peter Lavarnot, sold by Peter Lavarnot to Ford, and so everybody, of course, in Britain loves the Aston Martin name. And so we'd like to wish them luck, and of course, Lawrence Stroll is, you know, able to put into the team whatever it needs. And all of these top Formula One teams spend money like the American government, don't they? You know, it doesn't really matter. And it makes you wonder whether they're able to print it as well. Perhaps they are.
So right.
Just reminding me of that Aston Martin run at Le Mans in 1989, my last professional year, actually. And the car, you know, it would slow down the straight. We could follow the Mercs and the Jags. If one of them passed us going into the Porsche curves, we would be with it going onto the Marsan straight, all through the Porsche curve, better than, through the Dunlop curves, etc. But the minute we got on the Mont Sandy, it disappeared. We were doing 215 miles an hour. And the Mercs and Jacks were doing 240. So anyway, there's an hour to go when Peter Lavance, the team owner, and of course Victor Gordon, Peter that was really doing it all, said, "Man, would you like to do the last hour?" You know, kind of an honor in some ways, but we're not going to get any higher or any lower except through breakdown. So I'm whittling around. I'm pretty bored, really. There's a corner called Arnage to the right in second gear at about 90 miles an hour. And the Aston, the MR1 that was done by Richard Williams, would slide very easily in that type of corner. So for a few laps, I slid, you know, wow, like this. And then I didn't slide. And suddenly from the right-hand side of the road, there's about 20 British enthusiasts. And I get a huge handwritten sign, "Give us some oppo." So the next lap,
Hang on, lads.
I get another big sign saying, "Now, fastest lap." So the third and final time, crumpets and tea with the Queen.
I love the fact that you can read these signs while racing Le Mans.
So there was a lot of respect for Aston Martin and wish them, of course, you know, the very best of luck.
Go ahead, lads.
Brian, I mean, I feel like you're one of the guys that's always a pitch hitter, and you get called in to drive something. You've driven so many different things for so many different teams and folks. If I recall correctly, you regardless of what I have here, I'm a big Carroll Shelby fan. I think you crossed paths with that Texan.
Yeah, I mean, like the first time I saw Carroll Shelby was 1967 at Le Mans. And I go walking down the pit lane. I'm driving for a small British team, Lord Down, who are a great enthusiast, in a GT40 with Mike Salmon. And I'm walking down the pit, and I see this massive transporter, mobile workshop, backed up to the pit. And Carroll Shelby's there with his big steps, and he's shouting at the top of his voice, "Where's the carburetor guy? Where's the carburetor guy?" And from the top of the pits, in those days, you could have spectators, you know, above the pits. His voice comes, "Eyes up here, Carol." So Carol let out a few epithets and said, "Get your ass down here." "What? I can't." He said, "I've lost my parts." So that was the first time I saw Carol. I got to know him later on, of course, you know, on the historic racing side very well. Great character.
Good stories.
Oh yeah, we could make this show last about 5 hours. As far as I'm concerned, I would love to hear all that. We are just about out of time. I want to thank both of you gentlemen, Bob Varsha and Brian Redman. This is all about Murray Walker and the legend that he was. But Bob, I want you to know that I know a lot of Americans feel the same way about you in your Formula One commentating career. So I couldn't think of a better person to have on the show to help to wish Murray Walker the next life for him. So thank you very much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And Brian, same to you. What a wonderful joy you've been to talk about all the racing. And I think it was just a fantastic addition to the show. And thank you so much. And Jonathan,
we'll pitch in for a new shirt next time.
<That's Thank right.
you. laughs> We'll get you a solid color shirt next time. How about
we'll
that?
We'll send you a I'll tell you what, I will, for your birthday of what, 3 days ago, I will send you a Speed City shirt and you can wear it with it when you're not wearing your BRDC shirt.
All right. Well, thanks, everybody. And don't forget, we're going to do all of our Formula One pre and post race shows this year again for our fourth year. So tune into that and go to speedcitybroadcast.com to find out all about that. Thank you, everyone, and we'll talk to you next Sunday night.
Bye, John. Very much. Bye, y'all.
I know.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
You could spend the weekend doing the same old whatever, or you could conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.